Today's case show will be on case 41 in the Umen Kwan, the Mumong Kwan, the Gate of No Barrier. Case 41 is entitled Bodhidharma's Mind Pacifying. Bodhidharma sat facing the wall. The second patriarch stood in the snow. Second ancestor stood in the snow. He cut off his arm and presented it to Bodhidharma, crying, "My mind has no peace as yet. I beg you, Master, please pacify my mind." Bodhidharma replied, "Bring your mind here and I will pacify it for you." "I have searched for my mind and I cannot take hold of it," said the second patriarch. "Now your mind is pacified," said Bodhidharma. Mumon's comment, that broken-toothed old Hindu, came so importantly thousands of miles over the sea. This was raising waves where there was no wind. In his last years, he induced enlightenment in his disciple, who, to make matters worse, was defective in the six roots. Why, Shisanro did not know four ideographs. Mumon's verse, "Coming east, directly pointing, you entrusted the Dharma and trouble arose. The clamor of the monasteries was all because of you." For those of you who arrived on Tuesday night, this is day two of your sesshin. And I imagine that this morning was a challenging morning. There are always challenges in every sesshin, but for beginners, it's especially difficult. No doubt your legs hurt quite a bit this morning, and it was hard, if not impossible, to find a comfortable position. Also, your mind may have been far from a still and quiet. And so it might have been even more difficult to be still and motionless on the cushion. But I want to thank the new people here for their excellent effort. Let me encourage you not to listen to the voice of discouragement. Really, everybody in this room has been where you are now. Some people have been doing sesshin for 14 years. Some people have been doing sesshin for 10 years. And some people have been doing sesshin for more than 30 years. So there's something about the experience which is deeply liberating. Day two of your first sesshin, it's very, very hard. And everybody here is rooting you on, and everybody here has had the same pain in the legs, the same fatigue. I have to say that I'm always impressed by how well beginners hold up, since I was really a wreck during my first sesshin. So remember that you have only one resource in your practice on the cushion. I mean, you can always get up and leave the sesshin, and nobody here, I believe, will think the worse of you if you do that. So there have been a number of people here who have actually left the sesshins and decided to come back and try Zen again. In fact, one person left many times. It would almost be like you could set your clock The person on like day three of Sesshin would be, with a panicked look on his face, would be heading for the door. Really, it was just amazing. This person would come and get through 2 days and then just lose it. And the person would come to see me. Usually I was like working in the kitchen, and he would say, oh, that's it, I'm out of here. His face would be white like he'd seen a ghost. And, you know, I usually, I would try to talk to him, you know, but he'd go, and after a while, I'd just say, okay, goodbye, you know. So, but lo and behold, this person has been practicing for more than 10 years now, and is in this room even as we speak. So, you know, please realize that if you do leave, it's not the end of your Zen practice, and it's not the end of the world, and you haven't offended me, or let down the team or something like that. But if you stay, things will get better. I really mean that. I mean, you can say, well, how do you know? But this is a kind of a pattern, you know. Usually day one, people are still just thinking about their worldly concerns, you know. And at day two, they're really like hanging on by their teeth, like in the koan yesterday, hanging on by the skin of their teeth. And then something really does happen, you know. The part of the mind that is worried about small things becomes less prominent, and there's this other mind that begins to take over, and this other awareness, which is very difficult to discover at first, but when it happens, you'll feel very differently about things. And that will happen, you know, really. I mean, you know, Sesshin is a little bit, if you've happened to see the movie Groundhog Day, which is, of course, the most Buddhist movie of all time. So, they made a movie about several movies about the Dalai Lama. One is called Kundun, and one is called 7 Years in Tibet. And Jaru, who is not here, able to be here at this Sesshin, is working on a Korean film called Why Did Bodhidharma Come From the West? And that's also very Buddhist. And then there's that other movie, I think it's Summer, Fall, Winter, Spring, something like that. But those are all shallow treatments of Buddhism. The really deep movie is Groundhog Day. And there's no question about it. And Sesshin is like Groundhog Day, right? You know, I mean, first of all, you can pretty much be sure that every day, tomorrow is going to be very much like today, right? It's going to be pretty much like today. And so, you know, we're going to get up at 4:30, you know, sit, recite sutras, sit. Probably the guys outside will still be tearing up the road, and there'll be these huge explosions and beeps, you know. And this is pretty much guaranteed. Yeah. You know, as you're going, and you know, Bill Murray had it easy, however, in Groundhog Day, in a way, because he wasn't sitting motionless on a pad 9 hours a day. So, so this is even more challenging than that, you know, in a way. But it's like Groundhog Day because, you know, basically every day is going to be the same. And, you know, day one you're thinking, you might have all kinds of thoughts. You might think, boy, I wish I hope I have enlightenment and. Maybe this is going to be very interesting. And then day two, it's like, holy crap, you know. My legs are killing me, you know. And Maybe you have trouble sleeping. You know, who knows? It's the works, right? And you know, there's a certain moment in the day where you might be thinking, "Oh my God, I just hate this. I hate this." And let me out of here. You know, and I'm just, that's it. I'm getting in the car. And as I say, if you get in the car, that's okay. You know, but if you decide to stay, tomorrow's going to be pretty much like today. And yet, you know, something changes if you stay. There's something that's going to change. And it's like Groundhog Day. You can try everything, right? You can try, you can try willpower. You can say, I'm going to be, you know, I'm not going to let my pain push me around. I'm going to be tough, you know. Or you can pray, you know. You can say, please, you know, God, please, Buddha, help me, you know, take my pain away. And, you know, alas, you know, your prayers are going to be in vain. And you can also try to imagine your way out of your predicament, you know. You can be sitting in on a cushion and you can say, okay, I'm in Hawaii, it's Kauai, you know, I'm up looking at the mountains, and good luck with that. You know, that's unlikely to work. Right, because the pain is just going to cut through the imaginary scenario very quickly. This is actually quite interesting. You know that there's something elemental about this experience of pain, and beyond the experience of pain, there's other things too. It's like, when we experience pain, we're experiencing the limits of our ability to control our lives, you know? And normally we try to create a world in which we can preserve the illusion of control. But when we're sitting on a cushion and we're feeling a lot of pain, you know, the resolution we have, that strength of will often just melts away like snow in this hot sun, you know, and it can reduce you to feeling like a little baby, and you're going to cry, you know. So there's something unique about that experience. It's like I do not want to be here, and yet I cannot control the situation. I cannot change the situation. This could be understood as like a hellish condition, you know. This is not what I put in for. This is not what I put in for. And there's many different ways of experiencing this, of course, outside of Sesshin as well. You can lose your job. You know, nobody gets out of, you know, when you see people whose lives have gone really wrong, you know, it's always interesting to think about what they were like as little babies, you know. People come into the world with, empty mind. And when we see little kids, we're usually happy to see them because we think, oh, they have their whole lives ahead of them. And we think of like little kids as having like a life of possibility ahead, you know. But at some point in your life, you find that you don't have all these possibilities anymore. You know, this just happens to everybody, you know. And you might wake up one day and think, this is not the life I had imagined I would be living when I was 21 years old. You know, I never thought I would be here. My brother got cancer, and my brother got out of college. He was a biology major, and when he got out of college, he didn't want to go to graduate school, and he actually went to work for a very nice man who was in the Asian carpet business, a guy named Joseph Shaya, was from Syria. And eventually my brother had, you know, was really hard worker, and he became he worked his way up from a salesman in Shia's store to Shia's partner. And eventually he bought Mr. Shia out when Frank Shia wanted to retire. And my brother was always very good friends with Frank's son, who Frank Jr., who owned another store, another business. My brother worked tremendously hard to build this business up. And he had many, many ups and downs. He would often talk to me about how he had to go to court. Somebody would cheat him routinely. People would send him shipments that were minus a few carpets, and he'd have to take them to court, and so on and so on. And, or he once tried to buy some property for his store, and he signed a contract, but later the person who sold it to him got a better price and voided the contract through a legal maneuver in court. And it cost my brother quite a lot of money, not just in law fees, but... And I've talked about this before, but, you know, if you're a businessman, you have many uncertainties. You know, your business could fold. One year you're doing well, and next year you could be out of business. And my brother was once mowing his lawn, and his accountant drove up and said, "I need to talk to you." He said, "You know, you lost $25,000 last month." And my brother said his knees gave out from under him, like in the movies, you know. Just like he just his knees gave out, and he fell down on the ground. So he had worked so hard to build this business. And then, you know, when things were really getting going, this just happens, right? He developed cancer, and went through a long period of illness, and didn't beat it. You know? And when something like this happens to us, when we lose our business, or when we get sick. We're in a situation which is not so different from being on the cushion, and suffering a lot of pain. You know, you think, "I don't want to be here. This is not where I want to be." So this is really nobody thinks I am actually. There's a part of us that works like this. Everybody else is going to die, but I, fortunately, am not going to die. Right? You can't help it, right? You know, it's like I'm the smart little mouse. You know, all the other mice died, but for some reason I knew how to, you know, the reaper never got me, you know. I'm the smart little mouse, right? Everybody's going to die. So there's only so many ways to die, right? Car accident, cancer, heart attack, you know. But everybody else thinks, others will die when they're 45, like my brother, but I will live to be 90, you know, okay? So again, if you're a statistician, you know that isn't true, right? Chances are that's not true. So, I mean, we all imagine ourselves as the winner in the game of life, but it's very unlikely that we'll be 100% winners, you know? We all find ourselves at various times in our lives in situations where we say, "I don't want to be here. I do not. This is not what I signed up for." And then, you know, we can get at Sashin, we can get in the car and drive away. But in life, there's no car, you know, unless you want to kill yourself. You know, there's no car to drive away. So there's something very, very important about what we're doing in Sashin. Because my personal feeling is that, there's a way of responding to that moment where your powers are gone, and you can't control your life, and you're not where you are. There's another way of responding to that. predicament. And that's really very central to Zen practice. Most people, when you see people who go wrong in life, who really make bad decisions, I think it's often because they're afraid to be in the situation of people who are on day two of Sesshin. I really do. You know, where, you know, we don't want to be trapped. You read these cases where, this guy, Bernie Madoff, you know, this huge swindle on Wall Street. And you think, how could this happen? You know, how could he deceive so many people? How could he hurt so many thousands of people, you know? But I think he's afraid of what happens to us on day two of Sesshin. I really do. People will do almost anything not to confront that situation. You know, they'll lie, they'll cheat, they'll steal, they become alcoholics. You know, my father was from East Orange, New Jersey, in Elizabeth, New Jersey. He had dropped out of high school when World War II started. And he went into the Navy and fought in the Navy, and then he came out and he went back to high school, and then he went to college, which people in my family had never dreamed of doing. You know? And my father got out, went back into the Navy, and then he worked for the Department of the Navy, and he dreamed at first. My mother said he used to sit and talk about how someday he was going to be an admiral. My father never got to be even close to an admiral, you know. But he had a great dream, and it didn't come true, for a lot of many days in my father's life, he would get up thinking, "This is not what I signed up for. This is not where I want to be." And he didn't know how to deal with that situation. He didn't have the tools, you know. And so he became an alcoholic, you know, which is quite predictable. When you're trapped and you don't know how to get out, you know, you use the tools you have, and they might be, they can be things like alcohol, they can be dishonesty, you know, you can always steal, you can embezzle. You can also become deeply neurotic, right? I mean, neurosis is another way of dealing with the experience of powerlessness. You know, so we can surround ourselves with fantasies. You know, and this is quite common, you know. You meet these people who, when I was younger, you all know the rock star Madonna. There were people who used to dress just like Madonna, you know, like identical. And they, everything they did was like, they were like Madonna imitators. I remember reading an interview with some of them, and all I could think is, these people are deeply distorted, you know, because, you know, this is like the experience of, I don't want to be who I am, where I am. And so I'm going to be Madonna, you know. And it was really sad, you know, the degree to which they were like trying to live Madonna's life. It sounds trivial, but actually they took it very, very seriously, you know. So there's many different ways of dealing with this problem of being trapped, but Zen has a special way of dealing with being trapped. We get trapped by, we think we get trapped by our circumstances. We think we're trapped by our circumstances, but it isn't our circumstances. It's our own mental world that traps us. It is. You know, it is. we think it's our situation. You know, you could say, well, when your brother got cancer, that was a material fact, you know, but he was so unhappy about it, you know. We're all going to die, but he was, what really imprisoned my brother was not knowing what to do about the situation. And what really imprisoned my father was not having any strategies for dealing with his personal disappointments, you know. And we all have I mean, if you're young, you might think, however, will have no disappointments. But we all have disappointments in life. Mm-hmm. So we think that our situation is making us unhappy, but that's honestly not the case, in my opinion. It's the mental world we've constructed. And this world is deeply imprisoning much of the time. You know, so as we're dealing with various problems in our lives, we create a series of like walls around ourselves, right? And these walls and are meant to protect us, basically. You know, so we decide. When I was young, I wasn't any good at sports, and I wasn't. I had like really bad skin problems. I had like really serious acne, and I felt very low self-esteem. Even though I ran track, I was not, I have to tell you the truth, I never, ever got first place, and I never even got second place. You know? So I ran track because I loved track, but I was actually not a player in the world of track, you know. I was really a very poor competitor in sports. I didn't have any other options, so I got very interested in studying, not just because I wanted to be, I wanted to learn, but I thought this is something I can be good at, you know. And so I actually did best in high school in my English courses. And my teacher would compliment me, and I would write papers on great classics of literature. And after a while, I thought, well, you know, I obviously this is my strong suit, you know. This is what I should do. And actually, when I went to college, I didn't even think about studying other things. You know, I was just, in fact, I wanted to be a great writer, like the people I studied. And I realize now that I missed many opportunities to learn because I had an image of myself, you know. I closed a lot of doors on myself, and I think that was a big mistake. But we all do this, you know. We all decide, this is who I am, this is how I must live in order to be happy. This is what I must have in order to be fulfilled, and so on and so on. Those walls become prisons sometime in life. And so, you know, when somebody asked the Buddha, you know, what is the essence of your teaching? He said, it's freedom. And people like the idea of freedom, but they don't understand what the Buddha meant. You're not going to be free, from the Buddha's standpoint, you're not going to be free as long as you're in what we call your small self. There's a kind of freedom that is like the freedom to choose to go to Cancun or Kauai. But that really wasn't what the Buddha was talking about. There's a kind of freedom which, there's a state in which it doesn't matter whether you're in Cancun, Kauai, Lanoka Harbor, or Newark. See? There's a state in which those are not important. And that state actually is quite a wonderful state. It's really quite beautiful to be there. It's free. As long as you have this preference, right? As long as you say, well, I'm not where I want to be, I want to be somewhere else, that's a small self judgment. Now, please let me say that I like to travel. I like to hike. One of the best experiences in my life was going out to New Mexico, and I urge everybody to take advantage of a beautiful world. But that's not what I'm getting at, though. I'm not saying you shouldn't experiment or learn or change venues. But I'm saying there's a mind which is deeper than I like this and I don't like that. There's a mind that's deeper than, we all think that there's some point at which we just couldn't bear it anymore, right? For example, in Sesshin, in Japan, they don't have any heat in the winter. One of our members, Michael Pope, did a Sesshin at a temple called Bukokuji, and he wrote me and he said, it's 30 degrees outside, and in my room it's 28 degrees. And of course, if you read books on Zen, you could think, oh, cool, man, you know. But if, you know, you could, that's really neat, you know. But if you actually experience it, it's absolutely, on some level, it's really horrible, you know. I mean, you know, it's okay if you say, okay, I'm going to go outside without my shirt, you know, and walk to my car, without my coat, rather, in the winter, and say, oh, that was a Zen moment, you know. But when you can't get warm for days, you know, that's what it's like, you know. And Michael said this is true. He said this is classic Zen temple. He said all the wash water was icy cold, right? And he said he stank so badly that he decided to take a bath, and they gave him a big bucket of cold water, and it was 28 degrees, and he washed with the cold water, and that's what they all do. Now, you know, we don't do that here, fortunately, you know, but there's something really awful about being cold all the time. I mean, it has happened to me. I didn't go to a sesshin in the winter in Japan, but we had a temple up in the mountains in Seattle that was like that, and it was very cold, and I remember sitting in the Dokusan room. There was no Dokusan room, sitting in the Dokusan line out in the snow, right? And the snow was falling on the shoulders of my robe. I was cold the whole time. And it was like you go to bed cold, you get up cold, and after a while you feel like I'm going to lose my friggin' mind, you know? This is it, you know, I can't, I'm gonna snap, you know? It's so bad, it's like, you know, different people have different things they really hate, but I actually don't like the cold, personally, you know, in my small self. So, you know, at times I just felt like, I'm gonna go crazy, you know? But actually, you know, that something breaks inside you, and it's like, you drop out of your small self, and you enter this other other mind, Mushin. And suddenly it's liberating. It's liberating. It's so liberating. The ordinary small self is so fretful and fearful and angry and envious and, you know, it's tedious, right? It's like being in a maze or a labyrinth, right? Like there's this perspective and this story and this perspective and this story and this, and there's this, I like this, but I don't like that, and but you know, those sashins we had up there in our temple sometimes, I mean, even Genki Roshi one night, he went out of the zendo and I could hear him swear in Japanese, you know, it was cold, man. And I felt like I was going to lose my mind. It was like, if this, you know, one more minute of this, you know. But then something changes inside, and then your mind becomes very empty and serene. And you're no longer judging the situation, and you're no longer in your small personal self. Now, you know, it could be like that here in the Zendo, you know. People didn't necessarily sign up to come to a sesshin where there would be road work going on from sun up until sundown. When we come to sesshin, we might think, you know, often when we have sesshin here, there isn't road work going on. You know, there's, you know, people go outside and they walk around and listen to the birds, and you can have a beautiful sesshin experiences. But, you know, as I said, you know, sesshin isn't all about suffering or something like that. That's not the point. But there's something slightly wrong with going to sesshin and craving beautiful experiences, because you could call that spiritual materialism, right? It's like you have a scrapbook full of beautiful sesshin moments. And you know, you can keep putting new pictures in the scrapbook of beautiful sesshin moments, and you can think, you know, I'm really making progress in my Zen practice. But that mind is really quite false. You know, every time you come to sesshin, it's all about going right back to that empty mind, that mushin mind. Stepping out of the small self with its preferences and its fears and its elaborate defense mechanisms, and being in the moment, whatever it is. And how do you know you're really there? Well, there's no thoughts arising, or very few thoughts, and there's a kind of deep calm. You know, it's not easy to achieve, but when you are no longer frightened, and you're no longer angry, and so on, when you're beyond right and wrong, yes and no, and so on, it's so deeply liberating. It's like every muscle in your body is suddenly untensed. And this is the unified mind in accord with the way, is what we call it when we recite the sutra. Even though if this would be a challenging sesshin, no matter what, but because of the circumstances, it's challenging for everybody. But you know, it's a big mistake to think that this is a liability. It's the worst sesshin you can have is like this: you come to sesshin, and you sit down on the cushion, and you go, moo, 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 when is lunch anyway? Moo, 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 moo. Oh, gee, you start thinking about something. Oh, yes, I got to get back to moo, 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 and then lunch. And then, you know, day one goes like that, day two, and you leave sesshin and you think, well, that was nice, or you think, well, that was okay, you know. That's the really bad sesshin, in my opinion. You know, that's the sesshin that, you know, if you're sitting on the cushion and you're pissed off, or you're frustrated, or you're struggling, or you're you know, something could happen, you know. I mean, it might not be your cup of tea that they're tearing up the road next to us, but actually this is like an interesting place to be. It is. It's an interesting place to be. It's not like your last session, you know, but it's what's happening now. It's this moment. And the mind wants to, might say, the small mind says, I don't like this moment. This is not where I want to be. You know, I want to be at a beautiful temple up in the mountains somewhere, blah, blah, blah. But you know, actually, this is really interesting. It's a great opportunity. This is what Zen is all about. Zen is not about coming to Sesshin and, you know, grooving, you know, with all due respect, grooving on the bird sounds. I mean, I do it too. I love bird sounds. When I'm in Mushin, listen to the birds. You could do that for 10 years. Every Sesshin, you could come to Sesshin, you go, oh, day 3 of Sesshin, I love the food, I love the birds, I love the flowers, you know. And that's fine. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that, but that's like arrested development. You know, Zen is about finding your barriers and working through your barriers. So when you meet people who have been doing Zen for 20 years and they haven't accomplished very much, it's because they're not confronting their obstacles. And by the way, you might have noticed this, but nobody actually likes to confront his obstacles, you know. So a good teacher, you know, koans are very useful because they kind of force us to confront our obstacles. But life pitches us koans too, right? There's life throws us really challenging koans. They can be as simple as pain in your legs, right? So anyway, the moment you didn't want is your great opportunity. And it's easy to say in the abstract, it's easy to say, oh, of course, you know. It's like saying, oh, this, I read this story about these Zen monks, they don't have any heat, that sounds so cool, you know, it's so neat, you know. When you're actually there, you think, oh my God, if I don't get warm, I'm going to go out of my effing mind, you know. And then you get outside of yourself and you suddenly, it wouldn't really be true to say, suddenly I felt warm. That's not true, you know. But suddenly I didn't, suddenly there was no self there. Suddenly there was no self there. There was no one there. See, and actually, this has always been true. We create a self with all these little walls we build. But you know, inside all the walls? Empty. Empty. 100% empty. Bodhidharma sat facing the wall. The second patriarch stood in the snow. In other words, this is a very urbane Chinese man who had heard about this Indian sage up in the mountains. And he's miserable. He's unable to be at peace. And he wants Bodhidharma to make him accept him as a student. And Bodhidharma doesn't accept him. And finally, the second ancestor cuts off his arm to show that he's serious. And then Bodhidharma says, okay, I'll teach you. Okay. And in other words, you know, you have to be willing to be a little uncomfortable. You don't have to cut off your arm, but if you're always in your comfort zone, nothing is going to happen to you. That's good. Second ancestor stood in the snow. He cut off his arm and presented it to Bodhidharma, crying, "My mind has no peace. You know, can you give me peace of mind?" And Bodhidharma, it sounds trivial, but he says, "Show me your mind." Well, when the second ancestor looks into his mind, he can't find anything there. It's like empty inside, right? There's nothing there. So already he was a very deep person, right? He already had great insight. So this is like his beginning of his liberation, you know, going back to that. And it's like at the heart of the self, there's nothing there. It's like a very nice room with no furniture, etc., etc., you know, except there's no room. And this might sound very disappointing, but if you go there, you'll find everything becomes so extraordinary. So please, you're all doing a wonderful job, and especially the people who are here for the first time, have no preferences, have no likes and dislikes. Just cut away everything. Be in, if you're working with your breath, use your breath to sweep away your pain, sweep away your thoughts, sweep away your judgments. Just keep sweeping, sweeping, sweeping. And just keep coming back to the moment. And if you're calling moo, each time you call moo, your mind should become blank. And each you just want to move from calling moo to calling moo with blank spaces in between. This is how we purify body, mind, and heart. This is returning to what we call in Zen true nature. So please keep up the good work, and have no opinions for or against anything. Okay.